Hello everyone and welcome to JFG Tonight. Tonight I am answering to a request of the audience. Someone wanted me to review the Lee Cronin interview, Origin of Life, Aliens, Complexity and Consciousness. It's the kind of interview that is not super fascinating, to be honest. So if it wasn't a request, I wouldn't have done it. But when it's requested by Twigs on the Discord server, why not? I'm willing to go through, but it's a guy who has no insight. It's a guy who will reshuffle some of the information theory, complexity theory, will staple his own labels onto this. And as far as biology, he barely has an understanding of the selfish gene, let alone the revolutionary phenotype. So having people like this talk of the origins of life is dangerous, because you get misled into thinking that we don't understand the origins of life, when in fact I've published the theory of the revolutionary phenotype in 2018, and we understand how new replicators pop in, we understand how they are built as new layers of a genetic code. We also understand that extraterrestrial life forms will have certain characteristics that we share with them, one of which is the genetic layers will be there. There will be genetic layers that correspond to the number of phenotypic revolutions that have happened. None of this is mentioned in the podcast. Instead, what we have is the rehatching of common tropes in origins of life thinking. Oh, do they have RNA? Do they not have RNA? How can we imagine life without RNA? It's like, bro, we already know that there was life without RNA. There was a protein layer to life before RNA. This is demonstrated by the theory of phenotypic revolutions. And at this point, it's so sad because it's been 4 years. We're in the fourth year. People have to start reading this book. That's the next big progress of science, is when scientists stop farting bubbles of inefficient thoughts and start reading my book. But that's the job. The job is to have them read it. That's, I guess, my mission here. The Lex Fridman interview was particularly Lex Fridman. It sucked in every possible way a Lex Fridman interview can suck. As Lapitop describes, one problem with Lex interviews is that they are ego-driven. I love science. Science is amazing. And by implication, they are amazing. It's too feel-good. It's better than most science discussions, at least. Yeah, it's a big problem. It's annoying. Lex Fridman in this interview fails to connect with the improper theories of Lee Cronin, his improper use of label, his relabeling of complexity and entropy as what he calls assembly theory, which is laughable. And instead of connecting properly with this, either by contesting it or by siding with it, Lex is always with his open mouth, with like coming back on the theme of memory. Oh, so it's all memory. I see you're so fascinated by memory. It's like, it's not even what he was talking about. What the fuck are you talking about, Lex? Like, wake up. Wake up, Lex. So let's get through. And then we have some news. I can review the news. Importantly, the U.S. Embassy, apparently, or close to the U.S. Embassy in Iraq, there are missiles being dropped on it, and it seems that these missiles come from Iran. We'll know more as it develops, and perhaps tomorrow we'll know more about what happened and were there Americans in this embassy, or had they been evacuated? I don't know. But it seems that Iran maybe they are, or maybe they aren't. We'll know more when we figure it out. But the theory would be that Iran is using the instability generated by the Ukraine crisis and the general weak position of the U.S. to cause more mayhem. All right, so let's get started. We'll view the videos later, and I have some news item that we can talk about, but let's do the review of Lee Cronin's interview. So in the first 13 minutes, I will not play segments other than when I really want to capture a statement that he did. I will just talk to you about what he says and give my answers. In the 13 first minute, Lee Cronin claims that bonds allowed selection to happen. And what he calls bond seems to be chemical bonds, essentially. Bond between atoms as they establish more and more complex molecules together. That is the problem with this thinking is that it's very Earth life centered. Life, because this guy doesn't have a proper definition of life. At many times, in fact, in the interview, he contradicts himself on what is life and how do you define it. He never gives a clear answer that can remain stable across the interview. But if you have a clear definition of life, and we know what life is the product of mechanisms of replication, mutation, and selection. Life is what happens when you have these three ingredients. And the problem is that these things could happen outside of the chemical space that we have in the temperatures that are allowed on Earth. So you could have life develop above the universe, below the universe, at the quantum level. You could have quantum Darwinism. You could have life pop out in a totally different chemical world, perhaps inside the sun, perhaps inside objects in fusion. There's no reason why life couldn't exist there if the set of environments and molecules or whatever is present there allows for replication, mutation, and selection. So, yes, chemical bonds were necessary for the type of life that showed up on Earth to exist. At 1310, he says, biology is an amplifier of selection. So here he uses the term selection thinking broad. So the kind of selection that he's talking about is not just the natural selection in life, but the mechanism of selection as a whole. Like in the way, for example, planet Earth passing in front of the sun selects some photons out, leaving a shadow behind it. That would be a mechanism of selection that is not biology related. So to say that biology is an amplifier of selection, not sure it's the right term. Biology doesn't amplify selection in the sense that of making it bigger. And that's how I would use amplification. Amplification is to take something that has a range and extend its range. Although what biology does is replication, and as such, it creates a memory of successful steps in the exploration of selective forces over the mutational space. So amplification is not the right word, but memory perhaps is, and they talk a lot about memory in this interview, probably in an abusive manner, because, well, we'll get to it. At 1502, he then offers another definition of life, the simplest von Neumann constructor. But that's kind of circular, okay? Von Neumann constructor is the idea that von Neumann had to essentially capture the essential element of life. So a von Neumann constructor would be a machine capable of constructing much things, but including itself. Definitely, therefore, all life qualifies as a von Neumann constructor, but it doesn't have to be the simplest. It's presumably simple at the beginning, at the origins of life, and that's why you need the revolutionary phenotype to understand what is the beginning like. And the answer is the beginning is like a sequence of maybe 5, 6, 10, 15, 50 amino acids. That's all you need to start life. And he goes on to describe experiments that he does in his lab, where he's trying to develop completely new forms of life that would emerge from sand, as he describes it, sands and electricity, basically inorganic matter just put together. That's an approach that is quite unproductive, in my view, because it's quite trivial to have something happen a lot of times in a chemical solution. And it's quite, we would expect it very easily that you're going to get chemical reactions to cascade and therefore create one another. And when you have a cascade and you have these cascades throughout chemistry with various atoms combinations where the production of one copy will incite the production of other copies, then you already have some kind of replication going. But it would take millions, if not billions of years before you can create any form of complexity. So even if he was to accomplish what he wants to do in the lab, it's not going to be super interesting, and it's not a breakthrough. We know that there are many chemical reactions that will induce, that will favor, that are enzymatic to the self. They will favor the chemical reaction to happen again and again. So it's not a particularly productive area of research as far as I'm concerned. And ironically, in the very interview, he says that the origins of life research is filled with scams. And I think many of the stuff he describes doing is equally scammy. And at 1823, there's an interesting passage. Let's listen to it.
Working together, they can make more of themselves. But then they realize they can mutate, so they can make AB prime. So AB prime is different to AB, and then AB prime can then act back where A and B were being created. And
so that's almost true up to the point where he's talking about the acting back. So what he's describing are the fundamental elements necessary for life. So replication, you have AB, 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 produces more copies of AB, but eventually you get AB prime, you get a form of mutation in the molecule, but then this is subject to selection. AB prime will flourish if it is more efficient at creating copies of itself than AB. The effective act back, let's let him describe it in full.
Slightly nudge that causal chain and make AB prime more evolvable or learn more. So that's the closing the loop part.
So this closing the loop part doesn't exist in regular natural selection. The replicators are not working on themselves to make themselves more evolvable. The replicators only evolve. So that's a slight error, which from a computational perspective may not seem to matter that much, but it does. It's important to understand that the replicator has no self-improvement capacities other than selection. So that's why replicators converged eventually to a phenotypic revolution. It's because the self-improvement not being available, a replicator cannot make itself more evolvable. What it can do is manipulate its mutation rate, potentially evolve toward a greater or smaller mutation rate, but it can only do so through selection. And so it's always selection that will determine what kind of characteristics the replicator generates in terms of phenotype into the world. And the part where replicators improve is actually misunderstood here, because Lee Cronin does not understand the phenotypic revolution. When you understand phenotypic revolution, you realize that replicators that are in the need of improvement, they don't improve themselves. They end up creating a new replicator. The new replicator takes over the role through a phenotypic revolution, and that's how they end up being replaced rather than fixed. There's a difference between fixing and replacing, and a phenotypic revolution is a true replacement of a layer of the genetic code. Stephen Robinson says, Jeff, did you see that Trump went on the Nell? Oh, yeah, by the way, as Stephen Robinson has already done, join me on Entropy. It is my favorite platform for super chats. It's how you can support the show. You can also use the support button on Odyssey. They have an amazing USD option. Will you watch this Lex Fridman interview? That is my question to you. Are you interested in this discussion as I describe it? Steven says, Jeff, did you see that Trump went on the Nelk Boys podcast at the request of Dana White? In 2 days, over 5 million views. Then YouTube axed the episode. No, I didn't know about this. I'm not surprised because Trump keeps going around on these podcasts and he violates the rules of YouTube on election on election stuff, you know, claims of election fraud, and so it will happen again and again, and they're trying to generate a big cloud of shadow over Trump to ensure that he can't win again. Remember, this was what the social media giants were discussing in the back scene after seeing Trump win. How do we ensure that it doesn't happen again? Never again. That was what they were after. And so they're trying to make it so that Trump cannot win a future election. And Trump better get activated on his Truth Social stuff because he's going to need an alternative to express himself freely. New Nation says, have you tried replacing DuckDuckGo with Yandex, Russian search engine? A basic way I test a search engine is typing hot woman in the image search and seeing if I agree with the results. It may sound crude and naive to use that particular image search query, but in general, it seems to cover that with other search engine results I would agree with. No, it makes total sense. I don't know about Yandex. I would have to do some research. But yeah, it makes total sense because the great taboo that the SJWs have been trying to establish in 2022 and for many years now is the idea that they are beautiful women, and this kind of inequality that exists within the dating sphere, they want to axe it, they want it not to exist, and they're willing to manipulate their algorithm to make it so. It's going to fail long term. The companies that do that much censoring will end up being replaced by companies who can readily tell you what a hot woman is and show you images of hot women. It's actually you've invented a very clever measure, I think, because it circumvents a leftist theme, which is that, you know, all the fight for equality that we see in leftism, it fails in the dating sphere because the dating sphere never lies. It's like, yeah, if you're ugly or if you're untalented or if you're not rich, you're going to end up with a lesser partner, and nothing is going to change this. You may fool 1% of the population, 5%, 10% into making the wrong decisions in choosing a couple, but they will get punished by evolution, and down the line, down the generations, we all know what's down there in the future. It's like the super male, super muscle male quarterback of the football team dating the cute, blonde, hot woman. That is just what it is. 1823 says, Lee Ronan says at 1823, closing the loop makes the machine more evolvable. So what makes the replicator more evolvable, Lee? Is a phenotypic revolution, and it actually replaces the replicator. You do have to read this. I can't order you, but I strongly invite you to be aware of the mechanism of phenotypic revolution. It will resolve a lot of the misunderstanding that you have in this part of the interview. At 2305, they discuss an interesting question. Is it really hard to make copies of yourself?
Chemistry somehow, it's possible to imagine that kind of thing is easy to spring up. In more complex organisms, it feels like a different thing and much more complicated. Like we're having like a multiple abstractions of the birds and the bees conversation here. But with humans, sorry, with complex organisms, it feels like difficult to have reproduction. That's going to get clipped out. I'm going to make fun of that.
Yeah, man. I'm going to clip it out and make a meme about it. Lex, it's not hard. First, reproduction isn't hard. It is the only thing that links all successful beings of life for the last 4 billion years. Because precisely, you don't have to replicate, you don't have to 3D print a human body. That's why it's easy. What you have to replicate is the DNA that eventually encodes the relationship with the environment, which leads to a phenotype that we can recognize as human. That's why it's easy. So no, it's not a complicated problem that life had to solve. Life started with whatever works at the replication level, and then started accumulating complexity in the resulting phenotype, but always by doing the same thing. Copy the DNA that works. And of course, don't copy the DNA that doesn't work.
It's difficult to develop this idea of making copies of yourself, or no?
This is so funny in his style of interview. Lex Fridman just doesn't know what he's talking about. It's amazing that this guy is out there talking about so much things like origins of life that he doesn't understand. Is it hard or is it not? Well, it is not. It is a quite, when you think about it, replication is a quite trivial property to have. Now, you have to have a little more if you want to evolve into more complex life. You're going to need a mutational space. You're going to need a potential for that thing that replicates to be elongated and to contain more and more information. And that's just what DNA, RNA, and proteins have. They have the capacity to be in chains that have lots of variability to it, encoding different bits, two bits in the case of DNA and RNA, a little more for each amino acid because there can be 21 amino acids in the protein. It's not hard. There is a discussion about ribosomes, which makes it very important because ribosomes are extremely important to understand the revolutionary phenotype. Why do we have ribosomes, and what are ribosomes, and why are they mixed products between RNA and proteins? The revolutionary phenotype has the explanation to this because it explains why you had to have RNA generate proteins, and you had to have RNA generate DNA also, and you had to have DNA preserve the capacity of RNA to make proteins. But let's listen to what they say.
That is probably much easier to get to than we think.
Why do you put the ribosome as the central part of living organisms on Earth?
It basically is a combination of two different...
That is very bizarre as a statement. The ribosome isn't at the center of living organisms on Earth. It's not the statement by Lee, that's weird, but the statement by Lex Fridman here. It's not really at the center, although it's a trace of past origins. So the reason there are RNA segments in the ribosome is that the ribosome is actually decoration. It's a machine to hold these RNA segments that are the true operating system in the production of proteins. Let's listen to what Lee has to say first.
Different polymer systems, so RNA and peptides. So the RNA world, if you like, gets transmitted and builds proteins, and the proteins are responsible for all the catalysis. The majority of the catalysis goes on in the cell. No ribosome, no proteins, no decoding, no evolution.
So the ribosome is looking at the act.
Well, was there evolution before ribosomes? If we consult the revolutionary phenotype, one will realize that yes, there had to be evolution before ribosomes. Ribosomes come when the RNA life form has to produce protein. And before that, the protein life form was producing RNA as a phenotype. So you have to understand the ribosome from the phenotypic revolution perspective. You have to understand the ribosome as being what the protein first needed to eventually encode themselves into RNA, to produce RNA as a phenotype before it was a genotype. And there you had evolution going on. You had evolution without a ribosome. You had proteins reverse transcribing themselves into RNA, and the RNA helping the proteins to make more copies of themselves. So this whole activity of RNA producing proteins is actually a trace of a past state of life in which RNA was phenotypic. RNA was not part of a genetic code. It was merely helping the proteins copy each other. Eventually, RNA took over in a phenotypic revolution, became a replicator, and therefore was then a gene. It was carrying the genes and continuing to produce the proteins that would help its own replication. The ribosome that is modern is made of both protein and RNA, but the protein part must have come later. The protein part must be an addition that simply makes the RNA mechanism more efficient. Azeus says, this is my first introduction to Lex. I am not impressed at his intellect or him as a man, period. Well, Lex still tries to produce intelligent stuff, so I wouldn't go as harsh on him. But yeah, it's kind of annoying to have this brain that where everything is possible, everything is interesting, everything is fascinating, and I like in my intellectual contribution, I like a little more slicing. I like a little more, you know, there's 99.9% of the stuff that's not interesting. Here's the 0.1% that is interesting. They then go on to talk about the origins of life research is a scam. I think it's true, but I think Lee Cronin should include his own research in that statement. All these people trying to generate crap in the lab that has either the feature of replication or that looks like life, or let's create xDNA. This is all playing on the theme of life as it exists on Earth, and it's all inspired by life that we already see out there. So it's not a fascinating technical realization to be just producing some different molecule than what you would have in a living being, or those people who are putting together artificial cells, and it's like, oh yeah, you can copy exactly the genome of this cell, but you create it in a cell that is artificial in the sense that you've created it. It's all bullshit. It then says that biologists can't make a cell from scratch because there is information outside the cell. I think that in this segment, he appears to be giving too much importance to the cellular aspect of life. The cellular aspect of life must have come later than the replication aspect of life. I'm not telling you that before replication existed, there weren't some fat bubbles gathering themselves pretty much like the cells. Perhaps these molecules were there, and perhaps they tended to form bubbles naturally. But they had no functionality that made sense for life until some replicators figured out a way to encase themselves into those lipid bilayers. And I would accuse Lee here of giving too much importance to a feature that is not necessary for life. In fact, we have viruses that are alive and that don't have a bilipid layer, a membrane. Some of them are encased in proteic protection mechanism that are not fat at all. So that shows first that, yes, life is possible without these envelopes, although most of life other than viruses, in fact, all of life other than viruses, and including some viruses, do have the lipid layers, which suggests that in a world of water like the Earth, it's kind of necessary to maintain stable chemistry for maintaining reproduction. He talks about his dream of going from sand to cell in his lab. You're not going to have this because the evolutionary history between getting replication, getting selection, and then getting cells, that is a long evolutionary history, perhaps hundreds of millions of years. So I don't think that his lab is accomplishable, that his lab dream is accomplishable. I think you could create in a lab the circumstances where there's already plenty of lipid bubbles in a solution, and perhaps you could train a life form to eventually encase themselves into these lipid bubbles. But you're not going to get this from inorganics. From inorganics, you're going to get very simple life that will only survive in the specific circumstances that you had it evolve. But hey, you can try, I guess. They talk about the ethics of doing life creation and origin of life research, and they're kind of scary in not caring enough about the... Well, I've described the significance of creating another life form, and the big problem is that the life form we're going to create is going to replace us, because it's going to be a new genetic layer to our genetic code, and it will eventually have interest in stopping DNA replication. That is the problem of creating a phenotypic revolution within humanity. But Lex Fridman is going with the very naive approach of, we have to do it, because if we don't do it, someone else will do it.
Okay, that's a possible solution, except for the fact that somebody's going to do it. It's science and technology progresses, so we have to do it in an ethical way, in a good way, considering in a transparent way, in an open way, considering...
There is no transparent way in which you can initiate a life form that will take over your genes and that will eventually replace you. It doesn't matter if, oh, we're going to do it just in these medical instances, or, oh, we're going to do it just in the lab here, for just for this and that. Eventually, people will be tempted at using this technology to modify their genes, and they will say, why not modify my babies also? And they will get to a phenotypic revolution by eventually trusting another entity to determine the genes of their babies. Tillman says, Jeff, do you know how to add to home screen? The option does not seem to be there. Can you help? I'm using my phone. Thank you. I don't know that there is such an option, because they just pulled the they just released the Android app for Odyssey. So if you want to watch me on the phone, it's probably best to just install the Odyssey app. You can now find it in the Android Play Store. Lappitop says, Jeff, do you know about Greg Venter's work? Any comments? I heard he invented the shotgun method. Don't know much about it. I don't know what that is. I have no idea what you're talking about. Tameo says, why does clicking on JF's video bring me an Odyssey ad? That may be because you haven't refreshed. Perhaps your browser has a memory of the video not being live, but we are live now. So refresh your browser if you want to hear me. All right, they go on. So I fully disagree with this. We have to do it because someone else will do it, so let's find a way to do it ethically. My book warns that if we start playing with another life form, and eventually this life form informs us on how to modify our own genes, this life form will take over until we don't exist. The same way DNA took over RNA until it barely existed. You still have RNA viruses, but it's not the main life form on Earth. So if you don't want to become like RNA viruses, do not engage in the creation of a new life form. They go on to talk about existing life form out there on planets, and Lee doesn't have any insight into, and Lex is lost. will they look like us? Will they not look like us? These questions are useless. We don't know. We know one thing about extraterrestrial life forms. It is that they have genetic layers, because the theory of phenotypic revolution is true. They have genetic layers, and they may not be made of protein, RNA, DNA, but they're made of something else that has genetic layers. They talk about the possibility of detecting life on other planets, and I think that there is something quite revealing about the ignorance of Lee Cronin, and this is where I say he's contradicting himself on definitions of life. Look at what he says about detecting life out there.
In the universe, it would be similar to our life, and there's only one solution. And I think that what we've got to start to do is go out and look for selection detection rather than an evolution detection rather than life detection.
He doesn't go on to specify what that means. He wants us to detect selection rather than detecting life. But life is selection. Life is replication, selection, and mutation. So if you had detected selection, you would have detected one of the ingredients for life. How does that differ? And without a working hypothesis for life, his statement is meaningless. How do you do this? How do you split? How do you look for selection rather than life? And how is selection not life? We don't know where he stands because we didn't have a clear answer on what is the definition of life. They talk about humor. If humor is fundamental to the universe, and that is a discussion that screams my contribution from my second book, which I hope will be out soon so that we can have these guys read it, because they are totally lost on humor.
And play with those ideas, make them viral, mm-hmm. memes, you know. Humor seems to be kind of fundamental to the human experience.
And I think that that's a really interesting question we can ask. Is humor a fundamental thing in the universe? I think maybe it will be, right? In terms of, if you think about in a game theoretic sense, humor, the emergence of humor serves a role in our game engine. And so if selection is fundamental in the universe, so is humor.
Well, I don't...
If selection is fundamental, so is humor. I'm not sure what fundamental means here, but there's nothing fundamental about humor. It is a signal that exists between human brains. Now, the question of why it exists is relatively open, although it can't be a thousand things. Humor is something that people laugh at. So first, it's a computationally recognizable signal that needs to be flagged for reception. So that's the first characteristic of humor. The person who laughs says, I have detected humor. So why would you need to advertise your reception of a signal? Well, that may inform us on the second layer of our understanding of humor, which is you need to flag that you've received, because ultimately receiving humor is demonstrating something about your brain. So if I'm throwing a joke like an old movie in which a guy walks around and he doesn't know there's a banana, but everyone in the room knows there's a banana where he's about to step, and he steps on the banana and he slides. Ha ha ha, that is funny. What happens here is that those people who laugh are demonstrating to the people around them, and potentially to the guy who generated the joke, my brain was able to understand a couple of things that are complex, that are socially distant, like, oh, there was a banana, but this guy didn't know there was a banana, so it kind of illustrates a capacity for theory of mind. It's probably a measure of intelligence, being able to generate humor, and why would you need to flag your ability to understand humor and generate it? Perhaps because it's good for sexual selection. It's as simple as this for why humor exists and why it would exist specifically in the only earthly species that is sexually selecting based on extreme cognitive and cultural abilities. Basically, you don't have humor in other species because other species don't put that much importance in speech, culture, cognition. That's it. But Lex Fridman is having a totally psychological explanation of humor that is not compatible with biology. Look at this.
I actually don't know exactly what role humor serves. Maybe it's like from a chemical perspective, it's like a catalyst for, I guess it serves several purposes. One is a catalyst for spreading ideas on the internet. That's modern humor.
Well, humor as a lubricant, there's lots of features of humors that couldn't be explained by this theory, which is why the theory I just laid out makes much more sense. If humor is just a lubricant, why make it so complex? Why does it need to involve different states of mind and understanding that there's conflict between them? Why would you need that to lubricate your messages on the internet? That doesn't make sense.
Humor. But humor is also a good way to deal with the difficulty of life. It's a kind of valve.
Oh my God. And now we enter the... this is why every psychological explanation of human behavior sucks. There's no reason why life would evolve a solution to the harshness of life. It doesn't make sense. DNA doesn't care about the harshness of life. DNA wants to solve the harshness of life to lead you to reproduction. So there's no reason why a specific feature like humor with specific signal and specific reception signals like laughter, there's no reason why this would evolve to ease the pain of existence. There's no reason why DNA would evolve anything to ease the pain of existence. In fact, DNA evolved your ability to feel pain. This is so disappointing that in 2022, we are still at explaining to a bunch of public intellectuals that there is a difference between a psychological and a ultimate explanation. And the difference is that the psychological explanation is wrong. Ariel Soares says, I know who Craig Venter is. He denied races being biologically meaningful. He sequenced the human genome and apparently made some underestimation on the genetic variability of humans. Well, those are the signs of that we expect from a leftist academic. Twiggs Quadramale, who's the guy who asked for this... this interview review. He sends a super chat on entropy. He says, cheers for the review, JF. When I was listening to the interview, I was thinking, this guy is like the Bizarro universe, JF. Okay, I don't know what the Bizarro universe is, but by its name, I can imagine. It's a pleasure, Twigs, when you come with such content that is intellectual, at least, if not intelligent. I like to review those in full. Ariel Soares, because we don't have these opportunities much more anymore, you know, the intellectual scene on YouTube is very down. It's like there's no new thinking, there's no bold statements, so whatever drop of water I can get in this intellectual desert, I will review it. Ariel Suarez says, leftists are adverse to hierarchies of superior and inferior. To what extent do you believe it has its roots in their inferiority complex? It could, I mean, but you again, that's a psychological explanation. Ultimately, you have to ask, why would someone evolve? Why would a population evolve to have a lot of people who feeling inferior are doing activism to make a society where inferiority and superiority doesn't exist? And there you have the ultimate explanation. It makes absolute sense. If you feel that you don't have the good side of the genetic lottery, you would want a world in which the genetic lottery is a lottery where everyone wins. That is the whole explanation of why there's an association between leftism, equality, SJWism, social justice, and like incompetence. Ariel Soares says, ribosomes simply carry RNA in order to produce protein and polypeptides, as far as I understand. Do correct me if I'm mistaken. They do more than this. They carry the RNA, they read through it. But most importantly, on top of the RNA that they are translating to protein, there is inside the ribosome two little tRNAs, and maybe three, maybe the fragments of a third, but there's a complex of two or three sequences of RNA being held into the ribosome. And when you look into the sequences of these RNA molecules, they are very much tRNA-like. And so that's life telling you, the only way I ever found to generate a protein is using tRNA. And that's important. The ribosome is a carrier of fake tRNAs, new tRNAs that have been evolved from past tRNAs. And what it tells you is there's still only one way to produce a protein on Earth from the perspective of life. Maybe the it would be different in a lab, but from the perspective of life, still the only way our life forms have found to generate a protein outside of the lab, inside the cell, is a tRNA. And that's why the ribosome is carrying its two tRNAs, because they are plugs that can align properly with the rest of an RNA segment to output the protein. Drew D'Amato says, do you ever think about accepting the QNA, revolutionary phenotype, as an inevitability? Why or why not? Well, I say in the opening lines of my book that it's, how would you react if in the first few lines of a book, the author told you the book you've just opened contains the complete description of how humanity will almost certainly destroy itself? Would you close the book and hope that no one else reads it, or would you absolutely want to read it and spread the word about its contents to others? So I'm already saying in my book that it's close to an inevitability. But no, I will never accept that it's an inevitability, because we can't change the world. I mean, we could have a nuclear war tomorrow morning that wipes out any form of civilization, leaving people to survive in shacks in Antarctica, and that's it. If that was to happen, QNA would be delayed by a lot. So no, it's definitely not an inevitability in the sense of being the only possibility. Of course, the fight against the phenotypic revolution will be hard. It will take massive desires on the side of existing humans to decide to deprive themselves of a technological innovation, because when you look at the past, technological innovations are always good. You could argue that some of it is bad, but they always find their clientele, and there's always someone to find them good enough for them. So it will be hard to convince people to say, oh yeah, this is a time where we have to say no. No to a technological advance. But I think it's possible. And when you think of all the unpredictable events of the world, when you think of the Russia war against Ukraine eventually extending, perhaps, when you think of the possibility of the domination by over the entire Earth by populations of potentially Muslims who may have traditional beliefs and may not want to engage in genetic research, when you think of the possibility of nuclear war between countries just smashing each other down into Stone Age, there is still hope for a world in which we do not commit to a phenotypic revolution. The hope is grim, but it is there. And I will always stand for it being there until I die, and until every single DNA-based human being dies. There's a whole segment on aliens aren't going to talk to us, because it's like explaining calculus to a cat, where Lee Cronin here looks probably his weakest in this entire interview. And he's trying to psychologize the aliens and explain the Fermi paradox by saying, oh, they don't want to talk to us because we're too retarded, basically.
That's fine. But I think we don't actually have abstraction. No, I think you've in this talk, in this conversation, you've helped me crystallize something that I think has been troubling me for a long time with the Fermi paradox. I'm pretty sure that a reasonable avenue is to say that you would not go and talk to your cat about calculus, right?
But I would still pet it.
Sure, but I'm not talking about petting a cat. The analogy is that the aliens are not going to talk to us because we, and I'm using calculus as an analogy for abstraction, because we lack the layer, the fundamental layer of understanding what life is. And what...
That's absolutely ridiculous. And he was trying to make the case that we have to fund this lab basically to explore the mechanisms of the origins of life, because as long as we don't understand life, the aliens won't want to talk to us. This is one of the most ridiculous things I've heard on the origins of life. And I've heard crap all my life. But the idea that the aliens are somehow waiting for us to discover the secrets of life. By the way, we've discovered the secrets of life. You just didn't read the book. Holy shit. And then, by what standard do you think that the aliens even know that we don't know about the origins of life? This guy is all over the place. He doesn't understand what he's saying. How would the aliens know? How do you deal with the fact that when you launch a light signal in the universe, first you are flooded by all the pollution coming from all the stars, all the planets, all emitting their own light signals. Second, if you were to target it with a laser, you have to target it knowing exactly where the target will be in a million years, in 10 million years from now. It's basically unpredictable. Consider 360 degrees around planet Earth, you know. Suppose that someone was to send a laser toward us. If by miracle it wouldn't pass just beside us or beside here, and if by miracle this alien civilization happened to send this signal at exactly the right time, so that eventually after the millions of years it takes to get to us, it gets to us, it would still remain extremely improbable that we would capture, that we would receive this signal in any way, that we would know in which direction to hear, at which time to hear. It's impossible. I mean, think about it. Just sending a signal straight to the Earth in a way that will be recordable from a position that is 1 million light years away. You have to know in 1 million years where will the Earth be. You'll never know this. So that's why we don't have any communication from extraterrestrials, leaving aside the fact that we don't know how complex life is common. It's quite easy to imagine a universe where life is a relatively common thing. Life in the sense of replication, selection, mutation. It's another thing to determine how much of these planets will sexual selection appear. In how much of these planets will there be the accident that a male and a female is produced instead of a self-replicating entity, which sexual selection, in my view, is necessary to reach the complex levels of life, mushroom, plants, and animals. And by the way, my book also solves the problem of the emergence of sex, the evolution of meiosis. So you might want to read this one too. Lex Fridman makes a bizarre statement at 124:29 I know that he's trying to contest the statement, but still in making it, he is making an assumption, and it is this idea that RNA is the only way into life.
We took a quick break, and offline, you mentioned to me that you have a lab in your home, and then I said that you're basically Rick from Rick and Morty, which is...
Oops, I want to rewind a little more.
We took a quick break, and offline, that said, for difficult questions, for difficult explanations for rare phenomena, you have to walk cautiously, because... The scientific method, when you totally don't understand something and it's rare and you can't replicate it, doesn't quite apply.
Yeah. I agree with you. The challenge is to not dismiss the anomaly because you can't replicate it. I mean, we can talk about this. This is something I realized when we were developing assembly theory. that people think in the track they're on is so dogmatic, but there is this thing that they see, but they don't see. And it takes a bit of time, and you just have to keep reframing it. And my approach is to say, well, why can't this be right? You know, why must we accept that RNA is the only way into life? I mean, who said?
Okay, I thought the statement was by Lex Fridman, but it is by Lee Cronin. So he's asking, why should we take for granted that RNA is the only way into life? But that is not even the current state of our understanding of our life form. RNA was not the way into our life form. RNA was an intermediary between a protein-based life form and a DNA-based life form. RNA triggered the second or third, depending on how you count them, phenotypic revolution of planet Earth. So I know that he's questioning whether it's the only way, but the answer to Lee Cronin is no, it's not the only way. It's not even the way we emerged on planet Earth. We emerged through proteins, and this is proven by the theory of phenotypic revolutions. Stephen Robinson says, Jeff, when it comes to aliens, these people have a new age religious perspective. Science is not in the language. They think that these aliens are reading our minds from other solar systems. I mean, it's a terrible way to think, but it seems to be what he's saying. I want to extend him the benefit of the doubt, but he psychologized the aliens. I mean, do you realize that for aliens to be psychologized in that way, in terms of saying they don't want to talk to us because we're too stupid, you mean that the aliens have already been around, that they already recorded our brains? You know, without evidence, you think that the aliens know that we're stupid? How do they know this? Do they have super radars allowing them to track everything that's happening on planet Earth? And if so, that's kind of bizarre. It's kind of bizarre to have aliens not interested in communicating with us and yet being so fascinated by us that they track our every move, so much so as to know that we're stupid. Cosmic Nut says, did the stream fuck up? No, I'm still live as far as my recording system shows, so perhaps refresh the window. Sometimes Odyssey may not be perfect. Then we enter the part of the interview that's about assembly theory, and I will not play clips from this part, but I will describe rather, because it's rather long. And this is, you know, Lee Cronin got told by many scientists that his assembly theory was ridiculous, and I think he should have listened. So first, the word theory is not right for this. So his idea is, because he's a chemist, he wants to measure the complexity of chemical molecules by breaking them into parts and then doing some spectroscopy on it. And with spectroscopy, as you may know, you get peaks that are the peak absorptions of various molecules in the light that you light them with. So that's one thing. It's a method. It's a method. And Lee Cronin is thinking of using that method to quickly determine whether a sample contained complex molecules or non-complex molecules. Basically, complexity here being measured by how much parts can you be broken into. So if you have a molecule that can be broken down into 10,000 parts, then presumably it was kind of a complex molecule. And if you have a molecule that can only be broken down in two submolecules, that presumably would be a non-complex molecule. Now, that's one thing. It's interesting as a tool. But it's not a theory. This is not scientific insight on the chemistry or structure of the universe in any way. But he presents it as such. He's saying, assembly theory brings answers on, I mean, everything from free will to human consciousness to time. I mean, he's even challenging concepts of time in physics based on his ID. Now, this is kind of megalomaniac and totally out of reach of his stated theory as it is. his theory is, I think that if the molecules are more complex, so they are dismantlable in smaller, in more parts, then they are living. They come from life. And if the molecules were made of just a small number of parts, like 0 to 15, then they are simple molecules and they don't come from life. There is a fundamental error in what Lee Cronin does here, because, okay, he makes his case, he shows that he's done it in the lab. It kind of works in the sense that if you go out and you take samples in space and you take inorganic samples from industries or whatever, and then you take living samples, biological samples, you realize that his theory is roughly true, that the inorganic matter tends to be simple and the living matter tends to be complex. And this may be a tool with which we explore other planets. It may be a tool with which maybe we'll detect some degree of complexity in the chemistry of on other planets. But here's the problem. When you are on Earth, you are on a planet that was so covered with life for so long that at this point, if life tends to attract the molecules that form complex assemblies of part, then life will have taken all those molecules as part of itself, as part of its phenotype. See, his conclusion, he wants to say, when a molecule is complex out there in the space, it's life. But that's not correct. What may be happening is that life has an inherent interest in high informational capacity molecules. And therefore, wherever life happens, if it happens for long enough, like 4 billion years, life will eventually have reused all information-capable molecules in its environment. In other words, there may be molecules with many parts out there in on all the planets of the universe, and it's not a sign that life was there. It's just a sign that molecules of certain degrees of complexity do exist. But when life exists on the planet, life will take these molecules and make good use of it. So this may be what Lee Cronin is observing. I would call it a planet Earth bias. You think that complex molecules exist only in life, but that's because life absorbed these molecules and used all of them as it could on Earth. But on another planet where there's no life, you may have similar complex molecules like amino acid chains of arbitrary length and complexity. But there, you won't have them produced by life, simply because life wasn't there to absorb them and create them, and they may have been created by other mechanisms. When you start recognizing that chemical complexity can arbitrarily stem from the accumulation of chemical bonds, there's no reason why life would be particularly bent at producing long molecules, other than it may need to make complex information processing to increase its replication capacity. So again, we're back to life ends up doing whatever it does to survive and to thrive in terms of replication. He says very, very quickly in the interview, he says that he's talked with some physicist who told him that his idea of assembly theory was basically the idea of logical depth. And I agree. Basically, what he's reterming assembly theory is basically just a reconception of entropy, complexity, and formation, and logical depth. The whole idea that whatever out there can be described as an assembly of parts, and how many parts you can have, and what you could replace them with if you could put other parts in there, that is what information is, that is what entropy is. And there's no reason to develop a new term for this. There's nothing new in what he's bringing, other than he's limited by a particular methodological approach, which is the breaking down of chemical molecules. Armaluchis says, JF, so far you are the closest to having read Armaluchis with the correct pronunciation on the first go. Are you familiar with ecclesiastical Latin? You will be truly unstoppable once your transformation into a based trad cat is complete. No, I just know how to pronounce Latin, but I'm not trained in Latin. I haven't studied Latin, but, you know, I have... I'm just a man of culture, and so even without knowing it, I know how to kind of pronunciate a Latin word. But I know this from just having a lot of Latin words in my science experience, you know. There are so much Latin sayings in science when you study biology, so it's a reflex to me. Lapitop says, Jeff, you should try to play inside. It kind of reminds me of the Phenotypic Revolution. I think you would enjoy it. It's quite beautiful and atmospheric game. Okay, I will have a look at it. Not sure if I need a game right now, but I'll see what it is just out of curiosity. Stephen Robinson says, JF, it's like if we on Earth sent out a ship to a distant planet with the intention of seeding life, we as the sender have the tech to keep track of our people. These guys think the aliens sent us here and have been tracking us forever, waiting for us to get it or figure out how to get along before they make themselves known to humanity. It takes large amounts of psychedelics to really get into into the New Age philosophy. Okay, well, I think you are reading a lot into Lee Cronin's statement, but perhaps you're right. I mean, it was out there in terms of a comment. Last part of the discussion I'd like to cover and criticize is this whole idea that do cellular automata exist outside the human mind?
You mentioned something about do cellular automata exist outside the human mind in our little offline conversation. Why is that an interesting question? So cellular automata, complexity, what's the relationship between complexity and the human mind and trees falling in the forest?
Infrastructure. So the CA, so when John von Neumann and Conway and Feynman were doing CAs, they're doing on paper.
CA is cellular automata.
Yeah, just drawing them on paper.
How awesome is that, that they were doing cellular automata on paper?
Yeah.
And then they were doing a computer that takes like forever to print out anything and program.
Sure.
People are not with the TikTok, kids these days with the TikTok, don't understand how amazing it is to just play with cellular automata.
Okay, I mean, it takes a long time, but he eventually gets to say cellular automata do not exist outside the human mind. And that's ridiculous to me. A lot of physical structures resemble and basically perform all functions of cellular automata, including the boundaries of the space in which they evolve. Just consider life and a replicator. It's enacting a certain rule. It has certain boundaries, which are the space of physics, that the laws of physics that it will have to respect, and the space in which it spreads. Just think about a photon. A photon is like a cellular automata. It's advancing through space. It can veer right or left or up or down according to the gravitational field. It can follow certain rules, interacting with quantum fields and getting exchanged into energy and potentially creating matter or generating a jump of an electron in an atom. All of these are rules. They may be a little more complex than those cellular automata that we are used to, but they are, in every definition of cellular automata, they fit this description. They are little entities that follow rules and obey to boundaries in a world. So basically everything by this definition is a cellular automata. Carrie Goss says, Jeff, comment some on Ukraine at the end of the show. Yes, I'm soon done with this review, so I can comment on the Ukraine situation further, although I've been commenting every day, you know, since the beginning. So it's good to get out of it a little bit. And the final statements are on consciousness. He says there are more configurations of the human brain than atoms in the universe. How many configurations of the human brain are truly accessible? How many will actually get implemented into reality? I mean, I can dream of a possible human brain being in all sorts of configuration, but the reality is I look around on planet Earth, the actual human brains that exist are sheepish as fuck. I mean, it's, I can barely find a pro-Russian human brain. And there you are asking me to imagine all of the possibilities of the human brain. I think there's a kind of romantic vision that Lee Cronin has, that because the human brain could potentially be configured in all sorts of ways, that it is part of its capacities and part of its kind of freedom, space of freedom. But when you look at actual human beings, their space of freedom are absolutely reduced. I mean, so much so that a person like me, who just likes to think originally and would just like to be a little more creative and a little more contrarian than your usual human sheep, I mean, I end up getting banned from platforms. I end up having to censor myself. I had for years to censor myself just to survive on freaking YouTube. And then you realize, no, the space of possibilities of the human brain is not every possible way in which you could physically imagine reconnecting the neurons. It's the actual configuration that show up in existence. And this space of configuration is like tight. Tight to the point where just go on Twitter and find me someone who truly roots for Russia right now. You're going to have to pass through a million different accounts before you find one. And that one will be denunciated, by the way, as a Russian troll, a Russian bot, and a Putin apologist, and he will eventually get banned. That's just how little liberty there is in the deployment of human existence and human cognition on this planet. I know, because as a contrarian, I face the forefront of the attack on cognitive diversity. I am a target for these people. And so I know that the great romantic view of the space of human connection possibilities simply will not get implemented, because we're in a witch hunt type of society that will find any difference and pick on it and try to definancialize us. They end with the meaning of life, and Lee Cronin says the universe wants to explore all possible states. Basically, he thinks that life is an expression of the universe that seeks to explore more possibilities, while other tendencies of the universe try to cut away the exploration of possibilities and try to try to kind of limit what exists, and life is a path to expanding what exists. This could be said about anything. You know, the moon extends what can exist, because without the moon wouldn't exist. Anything that exists is ultimately extending what can exist, and anything that doesn't exist is a further evidence that it doesn't exist, that there are less things that exist than could exist. But yeah, in general, I don't think that there is. I think he's psychologizing the universe at this point. And the universe is not trying to do anything. It's just the way it is. And as it is, it allows the existence of self-reproductive entity that eventually grow into complex beings. So that is it for my review of Lee Cronin. As a summary and conclusion, I would say Lee Cronin is not a particularly interesting thinker. The interview was weak, and he has to read The Revolutionary Phenotype. That is the most important thing. That way, he will spare himself so much complicated thinking on all possibilities versus the possibility of life on Earth, and he will be able to filter away a lot of what doesn't have to be talked about and thought about. And we have to concentrate on the fact that we know one thing that is common to all life forms in the universe. And it is that they have genetic codes, because we have the mechanism of the theory of phenotypic revolutions. So you wanted some comments on the news. I can deliver swiftly some comments. First, Mama JF brought to my attention that Grimes ditching Elon Musk for Chelsea Manning as the internet questioning reality, an article in Forbes. So apparently Grimes, the girlfriend of Elon Musk, who just had a secret baby with Elon Musk, is now with Chelsea Manning, who is a trans soldier who had participated to the leak of information to WikiLeaks. That's why, you know, Grimes was, I mean, I'm just looking at the date to make sure it's not April 1st. This is not an April fish. Okay. Grimes has always shown some red flags, but I was wary of the danger. I couldn't have expected that spectacular of a conclusion. I did not expect this plot twist, says DK Shadow. How does that happen? And they've announced their new baby a couple of days ago. Now, I've done some research. As it turns out, their new baby is carried by a surrogate mother. And so the question is raised then, if it was a surrogate mother, is Grimes even the biological mother of this child? Grimes didn't produce the child in her belly. Did she produce the egg, and did they implement it in the surrogate mother, or is it just Elon Musk side-fucking another woman and designating her as a surrogate, or was she hired? Was this professional? I don't know. But it's... Firestarter says, where the fuck the sperm from? Well, presumably, if Elon Musk is the father, and I think Elon Musk is kind of based on this question, I think he wants to genetically reproduce himself, so I would expect that he's the father. But who's the mother? I'm not sure at all. I'm not sure at all. Lappy Top says, JF, can you watch the inside video I posted? Your reaction to it would be fascinating. Well, okay, little boy running randomly in the office. Little boy crossing a door. Listen, I'm a newsman. There's no news there. This is just gameplay. I'm not going to comment. I like the ambience and everything. It's kind of scary. And oh my God, what would happen to the little boy? But I'm trying to make an intellectual show, and you guys are giving me crap! In a Kiev basement, 19 surrogate... What's happening with surrogate? I didn't know, but there's a whole industry of surrogate babies in Ukraine. Oh my God, now the surrogate babies are trapped by war, but kept alive by nannies. So apparently Ukraine is such the hub of political corruption, sex work, surrogacy, that they're producing like industrial amounts of surrogate babies. And now you have all these Western couples that are like, we're waiting for this cute Ukrainian GF that you impregnated 9 months ago, and now war happens and you won't get your surrogate babies. I can understand the nervousness, but what the fuck is happening that there are people just internationally fucking other women to create babies that will be legally the baby of their girlfriend. I don't like it. I don't like it. ASB Military News. This is video of the attack on the Gostomel airport, but that's from the first day of the war. So we just get to see this video now, but it's been edited heavily, and it comes from the first day of the war. So basically we see them arrive in planes. So that was the taking over by airdrop of an entire airport. So you can see them airdropping, and they eventually advance toward the airport. There's some fighting with guns here. And they end up taking over the airport. I think it's part of the Ministry of Defense of Russia that wanted to publish videos where they are successful in their operation. Mariupol getting totally pounded by aerial bombardment and artillery. Lots of destruction all across the town. Of course, Mariupol has been under heavy siege. The Kremlin has arrested a Secret Service chief, FSB chief, in fallout from Ukraine chaos. The defenestration of several senior spies is a sign of Putin's growing fury towards the intelligence service. I don't know if it's, you know, the pro-Ukraine media is trying to make it look like this shows that Putin is pissed. I don't know. He may just be unsatisfied with specific personnel, and he's like, okay, this guy wasn't good in his information gathering. I'm firing him. I'm arresting him. But I don't know that it shows a systemic issue in the invasion for Putin. In Kiev, military missile launchers are installing themselves across the streets of Kiev with the hope of defending for the last siege moment. You know, those are really their last stand. They are in the Kiev city and waiting for their Russian enemy, and so you can see missile launchers being set up. Okay, I guess that what they're expecting is they will need these missiles to fire at the line of advancing Russian troops. Although, you know, stationing them in the streets like this, to me, makes it possible that they might be bombarded by air or from a very big distance from the Russian line. Today, attacks on airbase Kanatovo today in Kropivnitsky. We have seen the airfields being bombarded by missile, as we have seen many times in this war. It seems that they're just completing the job at neutralizing the air capacities on the Ukrainian side. Zelensky,
the CEO
pleads,
of the Ukrainian government,
I don't want to hear this. I'm doing a show. Please don't force me to watch videos, CNN. Zelensky pleads for more aid, says 12,000 Ukrainians successfully evacuated Saturday. 7 civilians killed while trying to evacuate Kyiv region, Ukrainian Defense Ministry says, and the Chernobyl nuclear plant running on generators with staff living there since Russian attack. By the way, I've been watching the Chernobyl, I think I've already talked about it, but the Chernobyl series on HBO, very good. 5 episodes, very good. I liked it. I know that some people criticize the series for being fictitious and not fully representing reality. One hilarious thing in the series is, you know, in all the series, I was like, there's a girl, there's a woman who's like the pro-nuclear physicist, and she's like the one who sees everything, and she's the one who figures out just from a from a sample of the air in Minsk, and she figures out, oh my god, there's something wrong happening in Chernobyl. She's like the full genius, elite nuclear physicist who just outcompetes everyone in the movie and is even better than the big professor that gets invited to inspect on the thing. And at the end of the series, they say, by the way, this woman was a fictitious character. She has been introduced in the series to represent the collective effort of all the workers who saw what was wrong with Chernobyl. And she represents the collective. She doesn't exist. Okay? It's like, this is the one woman scientist in this whole thing, and she doesn't exist. I was like, oh my god. They did it, and they've been so transparent about it that they add a warning at the end of the fifth episode. So basically, all of the names in there, they're all real. Well, most of them are real people that were truly involved in the Chernobyl explosion, except her. She's just a representation of other workers. All right, we have videos of what seems to be a plane or maybe an helicopter crashed in the field. Okay, so this is happening also. Lots of aircraft being targeted by the Ukrainian defense. Russia threatens to attack on NATO weapon shipments to Ukraine. We will consider them legitimate target. So going forward, if some weapons are making their way toward Kiev or in support of the Ukrainians, they will be targeted as legitimate target by the Russian army. Evropa Aesthetica sends a super chat. He says, I recently discovered the Quebecois traditionalist song Degeneration. It is one of the most apt songs I've seen describing our current societal condition. Good job, JF. You are returning to the wonderful lifestyle of your arrière-arrière-grand-père. This should be the aspiration of us all. Yeah, it's a great song in terms of what it says, because it's kind of a hyper-based, like, everything was fucked up in the boomer generation and slightly before, and the young people of today are kind of returning to the ways of their great-great-grandfathers. I can offer a quick translation, if you'd like, of what this song says. Okay, there it is, actually already translated on the internet. Your great-great-grandfather, he cleared the land. Your great-grandfather, he plowed the land. And your grandfather made the land profitable, and your father sold it to become a state employee. As for you, my boy, you don't know what you're gonna do. In your small one-bedroom, way too expensive, cold in the winter, some wants to become an owner, come over you, and you dream to become an owner, and you dream at night to own a small plot of land. Your great-great-grandmother, she had 14 children. Your great-grandmother had almost as many. And your grandmother had 3, it was enough. And your mother didn't want any, you were an accident. As for you, my girl, you change partner all the time. When you do something stupid, you get out of it with an abortion. But there are mornings you wake up crying when you dream at night of a big table surrounded by kids. Your great-great-grandfather lived in misery. Your great-grandfather collected pennies. And your grandfather, miracle, became a millionaire. And your father inherited it and put it all in RRSPs. As for you, young one, you owe your ass to the government. No way to get a loan in a banking institution. To calm your urges to hold up the cashier, you read books about voluntary simplicity. Your great-great-grandparents, they knew how to celebrate. Your great-grandparents were swinging hard at parties, and your grandparents saw the ye-ye period. Your parents were discos, that's where they met. As for you, my friend, what do you do with your evening? Just turn off your TV. You shouldn't stay inside. Luckily, in life, some things refuse to change. Put on your nicest clothes, because tonight we're going dancing. Very interesting text. And this was mainstream music in Quebec for a while. Mes Aïeux, you know, they have been kind of getting it. But unfortunately, long term, they converged toward depoliticizing their songs, and they started kind of hating being put in that box, I think. And they've become irrelevant with time. But when they were writing these things, that was great Quebecois traditionalism. There was a rise of that kind of song at a certain era, like 10 years ago in Quebec. And there are some great sovereignist nationalist songs by this group. Yeah, it's really a great song. The music video is kind of based too. Yeah, I think I may have seen it. I don't remember. A New Nation says, has anyone sent/mailed Lex Friedman TRP? I did write an email to him, but he didn't answer. So that's always the problem with the revolutionary phenotype. It contains the answer to the emergence of life, and yet people don't read it. Stephen Robinson says, Jeff, what do you think of Alec Baldwin's defense that Hallian killed herself on the set of the movie Rust? Well, I saw the claim, but I don't know how he claims this. What does she claim she did? I have to read more about it. I didn't have time to do it before the show, but I will check this. But yeah, apparently Alec Baldwin claims she killed herself. Could be true, but I have, what is, how did she do it? Does he claim she pushed the trigger herself? Maybe she did, you know? Stephen Robinson says, JF, Ukraine biolabs were harvesting adrenochrome from the surrogate babies. It is the sick world of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Oh my God, you're mixing different conspiracy theories here. I cannot see this as being a good practice to reach the truth, to take all these very unlikely conspiracy theories and smash them together like this. I think it's just even more unlikely. Breaking: humanitarian situation in some Ukraine cities catastrophic, says the Russian military. It's interesting to hear the Russian military say this, because of course you're going to have the pro-Ukraine people say, well, it's because of your invasion. And that is certainly part of the causes, you know, but I suspect that life in Ukraine wasn't spectacular either before the invasion. Americans panic hoard ammo in wake of Russian invasion of Ukraine. Of course, that's always what Americans do. That's why we like them. Ukraine war: Kyiv prepares for Russian attack. That's a picture of a Kyiv street before and after. Okay, they've put some wheat inside, maybe sand inside tires, and then they've put some pockets of sand. Listen, I guess it's what you can do, and I guess this can help you psychologically set a boundary where you intend to fight the Russians. But technically, you know, given the power of the artillery and missiles we've seen, it doesn't seem like this will constitute a serious obstacle. Like, I can imagine a couple of tanks shooting their shells to this, and eventually it just blows up. Russian armed, we've seen entire buildings blow up by these missiles or artillery. Russian armed forces have destroyed a freshly resupplied ammunition storage of the Ukrainian military. So if you've ever wondered where does your tax money goes in, it goes into resupplying these little contingent of the Ukrainian army, and I believe that they will shoot a missile right in the they will shoot a missile right on the target there. I will not play the rest of the video, but if you're interested, you can follow up the links. By the way, some people wanted the links from the show yesterday. I remind you, all the links that I use on every show is always included in the list below. You just have to go to the line that says new, all links used in the show. You follow the link to the HTML and you're going to get all of the videos I use during the show. We had strikes happening. Here you will see this being struck by a missile. I don't know if it was intentional or if it's a missile going in a wrong way, but different strikes are happening across the Ukraine. What else did I have that I wanted to show? So that was what I talked about at the beginning of the show. Somehow the U.S. consulate in Erbil, Iraq, has been targeted by missile. Boom. It was quite the volley. I mean, let's look at it again. Look at it. Boom. So apparently those are ballistic missiles headed toward the U.S. consulate in Iraq. The missiles would be coming from Iran. What does that mean? What will be the reaction of the Americans on this? I don't know. But it's what we know for now. There seems to be an attack. Also, as a last comment before we close the show, Francis Fukuyama. This went pretty viral on Twitter and it trended. He wrote a text called Preparing for Defeat, where he claims that Russia will be defeated in this war. This remains to be seen. I mean, they've been doing extremely quick progress and they wouldn't even have to win Kiev in the next week, 2 weeks. They would just have to let Kiev tire itself and win more and more cities. They've already replaced the mayor of Militopol with a kind of military type of governance. It looks like it's going well for the Russians, and I think this is more the pro-Ukraine leftists just cheering for themselves and trying to keep up the morale. But when you look at his analysis, what is it based on? Well, all of the talking points you'd hear in Twitter, pro-Ukraine type of stuff. It's like, oh, he's been slowing down. And, there was fierce resistance on the side of the Ukrainians that Putin did not expect. There's no evidence of this. If Putin was somewhat smart, he would have understood, and I believe that he must be at least smart enough to understand that if you invade a developed nation of white people, it's going to be a little harder than a non-developed nation of non-white people. I mean, it's just the fact of they will be more equipped, they will be more trained, there will be therefore more losses and more cost. I think Putin would have been very ignorant if he didn't know that. So that is it for today. Oh yeah, one other thing. Idiocracy. CDC lowers the expectations for child development, raising new questions for parents. The CDC has changed its list of children's developmental milestones for infants and young children, marking the first update of its kind since 2004. So the updated checklist moves milestones back so that 75% of children should reach them at a given age. That is very interesting. They're saying since people are becoming more and more stupid and developing less and less toward intelligent adult beings, we're going to adjust our threshold so that 75% of the children will pass them. at any point in time, and it's going to get renormalized constantly. So if our society is headed toward a kind of dysgenic or eugenic of lesser intelligence dominating the world more and more, this threshold will constantly adjust itself to have less expectations. And I mean, we could farm ourselves into ape level of intelligence, like chimpanzee level intelligence. And the CDC would tell you, oh yeah, you know, a child starting to say their first word at 23 years old, that is perfect. He's within the 75%. That is it for tonight, Buzz. Thank you so much for being with me. Will you watch this Lex Fridman interview? 5 people say no, 1 person says yes. Yeah, it was. I watched it because there was a request by the audience member, and it was a pleasure to do it, but it's not an interview that is worth watching. Much love, see you all tomorrow. Thank you.